Today, we're privileged by having Zoe present her work on using machine learning in relation to supernovas and dust. Hi, Zoe. We see you.
Hello. Yeah.
And we hear you. Excellent. Nice. And the remains of the day will be used in the same way as we always have, namely, we will keep Zoom on and be on Slack and everything else. I have a short corona modeling meeting, but otherwise, I'm also here. And in the afternoon, we will give feedback and present results on the small project. So that starts 1:15, is the plan. And that's the plan of the day. Any questions or comments to that before we give the word to Zoe? No? All right. Well, then without further ado, please. Zoe?
Hello, everyone. So this is me, and I want to talk about one of my projects, which I call it Supernova Dust Detection. So I'm going to share my screen with you and start the talk. Okay, can you see my screen?
Yes, it's there.
Nice. Okay. All right. So supernova dust detection with the neural networks. What I'm going to talk about in the following is a brief introduction on astrophysical aspects of the project and data, and why I choose to detect the dust. And also I will give a little explanation on my simulation method. And after that, I will talk about extracting desired features from those simulations and why I chose them. And at the end, I will talk about several struggles on choosing the right model, which can give us a pretty precise estimation on dust mass. Here we go. This is a supernova, which is actually an event that is happening at the end of the lifetime of some of the stars with specific range mass. So supernova is actually basically, it's a huge explosion that makes a very hot environment around it. And there would be lots of chemical reactions, therefore it forms dust. As you can see in this case, we do have one stellar core in the middle here, and also a shell which is formed, a shell around the core which is formed with the dust. So if we didn't have any dust around the core, what we could see was actually some intensity, some flux values, from the core to our eyes, which does have different values in different wavelengths, right? So it makes this shape of the curve, it makes these curves actually, which somehow represent the core. But in the real world, we do have this one. What we can see is actually from this point of view, which includes the dust, which actually somehow affect the curve. But then thanks to Planck, which we can actually use black bodies and somehow get some information of properties from any sources based on those black bodies. It could be just the core or also the core plus the dust. So basically we can fit this shape, this curve, which we call it a spectra, to a black body equation, which is a physical equation, and calculate several properties of the core and also the dust. These properties are actually radius and temperature of the supernova and also the temperature and the mass of dust. So basically what we are doing is actually we are getting these curves from the observation, then we actually feed them to the blackbody equation and we extract this information. we also can just somehow consider some ranges for those features, for those parameters, actually the temperature and radius of the supernova and temperature and the mass of the dust, because we already have a good knowledge about which kind of supernova actually forms dust. So we can consider some of the range and build our own black body equations, which I already did. Like here, you can see a sample of the data points that are generated with the black bodies. And at the bottom of plot, you can see these blue and purple curves, which don't have dust at all. But these four at the top do have. And based on the radius and the temperature of the supernova, they do have different first peak. And based on the temperature and mass of dust, they will have different second peak. But the problem with that is actually, there's two problems here. I can use each of these curves as a data point to my model, which includes up to 20,000 data points, right? Which is quite a lot, and it makes the model runs very slow. And also there's a real world issue, which is astronomical spectroscopic data is very rare to get because they're so expensive to get. So there are not much data. If I just train my model based on these spectra, I can't use much prediction on dust mass because I don't have that much data to train or test my model with. So there's another kind of astronomical type of data, which we call it photometric bands. And here is the James Webb Space Telescope, for example, which can provide those bands, and it will be launched in March 2021. And here are the photometric bands for this specific telescope. And basically what is actually doing, somehow getting average in a range of wavelengths, and instead of giving lots of flux values, it gives us just one value for this range. So I've used some built-in Python library called PyPhot, and I've tried to extract the photometric bands from my blackbody curves. As you can see, these little data points here, these are actually my bands. So instead of using 20,000 input features, I just simply use up to 27 of them. Okay, after that, in order to get the dust detection from supernova, I've split my task in two different types. Classification, which actually I was trying to identify the existence of the dust from my blackbody curves, from the photometric bands actually. And the second part was that I was trying to just consider those data which does have the dust from classification and estimate their amount of dust with the regression. So for the first task, I simply just used some convolutional neural networks. It's very simple, I didn't do anything on that. And what I got was like this result, which gave me like up to 86% accuracy, which is quite okay for this step. I've improved it a little bit, but for this case, I just keep this one and move to the regression. I just want to note that I've used sigmoid for the last layer in this architecture. Then I move to regression, and instead of using sigmoid in the last layer, I've used linear, which is somehow one-to-one function, because simply in a regression case, we want to get like one value of dust mass corresponding to one set of weights, which we can get from the neural networks, which actually represent each individual blackbody, which does have their own four parameters that I've mentioned. So instead of using this fancy activation, I've just used the linear one, very simple. But then I got was like this. So in the x-axis, you can see these are the actual dust mass and the y-axis, you can see the prediction of my model, which is not quite nice, right? We are actually expecting something like this, some diagonal line here. That would be our desire, but this is what I got. So I've confronted with this issue with several things, but I just want to talk about two of them here. First, I put a step back and looked at my data to see how actually machine can look at them. For example, these two shapes belongs to two different data points. They do have the exact same temperature radius for supernova and the temperature of dust. So these are the same for these cases. But for the left one, we do have one mass of sun as the dust mass, and the other one does have 100 mass sun. So it's they look pretty the same, right? And it's really difficult for the machine to detect them. Especially, you can see them here, I guess, but the flux values are between the range like 10 to minus 16 to 10 to minus 19. So these values are very low and makes it even more difficult for machine to somehow distinguish between these two data points. So instead of using these values, I've just changed my input flux values to a logarithmic scale. And what I got was something like this. You can see it actually tries its best to somehow push the data points up to the desired diagonal line, but still it's not enough, right? Okay, I went further and look at the loss function and to see how I can actually make the prediction better all over the range of dust mass. As you can see, for a very low dust mass, we do have pretty much good predictions, right? But as it goes up, the prediction just falls down, the accuracy falls down, it's not good. So these are two loss functions, which are basically mean squared error and mean absolute error. And what you're doing is actually one of them, for example, mean absolute error, try to get a mean value of absolute of differences between actual and prediction value. In our case, is dust mass. And the other one is just goes for the square of this difference. And they do have these shapes. So what I wanted to do was like using one of them for data points up to one and using another one for data points with error, actually with error higher than one. Because in that case, we are getting pretty much similar results all over the data points. You know the data lower than one is a little bit tricky, right? Because of the differences, they're actually scale up. And the different if you square the differences, they're going down, but for the values for higher than one, the differences when they are squared, they're going up. So I wanted to make them unique, as a similar thing for them. There's a built-in loss function called Huber, which is actually doing that for us. If you just set up a delta value, which is in my case is one, I can get the combination of these two. So I just simply use that one with the delta one. And then I changed a few things in my architecture. For example, I've dropped the dropout layers. I did have one dropout layer, and also I've added two fully connected layers at the end of the model. And also I've just played with the activation functions to see what is happening. Then I've used a Huber and put my model to run for like 3000 epochs. And this is what I got. It looks pretty much good, right? So I was confident at this point, I was very confident that my model, I just put it for more epochs, like 2000 more epochs, and get even better. So as you can see, this is also the end of my talk because I got the right result. And also, if you're interested in more details and like to look at the models and how actually I confronted with these issues, there is a GitHub link in the Slides and Slack channel I can refer to. And that is the end of my talk. Thanks.
It's all on mute, and salute Zoe, please.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Zoe. Questions, please. Yeah. Vicky, was that a question or no? All right. Then I have a few. Generally, how well does the method generalize? Have you tried it on, you know, new data taken perhaps under other circumstances? Does it work as well? Have you tried that, Zoe?
You mean changing the model or like testing it?
Testing the model.
Yes. So the problem is that we don't have much data, even in photometric data set, which are actually referring to dust. Okay. So we do have lots of data, but we don't know the actual dust mass for them. We do have like up to maybe 20 objects that we are sure about their dust mass. I've tried several of them. And I also put it in a GitHub, and they actually predict them pretty well.
Okay, so you have some confidence in that this works.
Yes.
What did people do before?
So basically, there are no works on the blackbody modified blackbody machine learning method, but there are some spectral machine learning method, which is one of them, is a very famous one. The group name is Dash, but they are not actually addressing the dust mass at all. They're just looking at the classification of supernovae. So they're just gathering all the spectra instead of using the black body.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Any questions still? Or still not? Come on. All right. Janet has a question which is not related to this, but that's fair enough, Janet. Please bring it on. We can't hear you. Though I see you are unmuted. Nope. Otherwise, you can write it, Jana. And the mics are open.
Okay.
Ah, there. Now, here we go.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Great. Yes, it was about the sharp values. Excuse me, I apologize for this redundant question. I know that we've been asking that a lot. But we were discussing in our group, and for all of us, I think, it wasn't completely clear about how the features of importance can be ranked after the model is run. And at least the PCA analysis, I understand that is a non-supervised learning. But I would like you to clarify of the analysis behind sharp values a little bit more. and perhaps a difference apart from the workflow, but which is behind, what is behind the process. Thank you.
You are muted, Tolls.
Sorry, I'm sitting here looking for it, thinking what week we had about this. If it was week four. Yeah. All right. So actually, to answer your question, I'm going to go back to the talk of week four, which is input feature ranking or shared values. Yeah, you see it?
Yes.
All right. And one of the things you could do, which is very simple, is permutation importance. The idea simply being that you say, for one of the variables, I'm just going to switch around the value so you get a random value of that type. So it corresponds to having a column where you just randomize that column. Okay? Does that make sense, Jana?
Yes.
And then if that doesn't do anything, then it's not important. And if that ruins the prediction, then it's very important. Right? It's sort of shown here. Right? So you say, is height important? Well, I'm going to just switch them around randomly. And if that doesn't have any impact on the prediction, then it's not important. All right, Shapley values come from a different line of thinking because they come from what's called cooperative game theory, which is if we're a lot of people in a game trying to gain as much as we can in that game, then how important is each player and what payoff can the player reasonably expect? And this actually applies very much to the line of thinking in life. You could say that all human beings are in one big game on Earth, and but just in a company, right? If there are three owners of a small company and they make money, should it be split 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, or is there somebody who should have more, and based on what? And so that's what the Shapley values try to sort of answer. So first of all, if you take all the Shapley values that are assigned to each of the agents, so that could be three persons in a company, then of course the sum should be the grand total, namely how much they earned together. And well, there are a few other things that you want it to have in. You want it to be linear. You want, well, if you don't participate, you get zero. And this is, you know, a very math mathematician type, you know, we have to set that in. And again, it has to be anonymous in the sense that it shouldn't be depend on the order in which you give the players. It's what they contribute with. And if a player is not part of that collaboration, well, then exactly the player's value should be taken out. So, and if you do that, well, then you get a function and it can be calculated as follows. But maybe on the next page, there are several ways of calculating it. But I actually like this one the best because it says, all right, take the value of all the other players, including the player at hand or the participant or the person in the company, and ask how much do they earn together, and then subtract from that what would they earn if the player was not part of it. Okay? And then sum this over all the possible constellations you can have here and take an average. And what's the number of constellations you can have here? Well, that's the you can have n faculty constellations, so you divide by 1 over n faculty. And that's how much you contribute, right? It's how much more you add compared to what if they were without you. And calculating that in reality is very complicated. And that's why we're happy that there's a GitHub reference and a module to include that can give us this. And actually, what this plot typically shows is the sum of the values, SHAP values for all events, right? So here they're called, these are variable names, right? But they could be persons in a company. Mm-hmm. And clearly the person else that is very important for the company, because if he or she leaves, the income will go down a lot. And RM is another important person. So they should get the largest share of what they get out. Now, this is evaluated over all events, but it might be that there are some events where their SHAP value is low and some where it's high. Mostly it must be high because the sum over all events is high. But what the SHAP values can do is not just to say how important is each person, but it can say how important is each person in each case. Okay? But it's from the collaborative game theory part of view that it comes. Yeah, please.
I was about to mention about the formula you showed. So SHAP values are more, it's like a simulation using a distribution, right? Like a Poisson or
the
probability, right?
Well, the thing that you have to have is this function V, right? If I come with a set of in our case variables, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to say how well will the machine learning algorithm do with those variables.
So the approaches are different, but I think it's clear now. I mean, the SHAP analysis compared to PCA.
Okay, and perhaps what I was not clear about enough on, it's good that you, so this function V is what tells you how well does my algorithm work given these variables, right? And then how well does it work if I don't have this variable in? The problem is that we don't have V, but what the implementation of the SHAP values do is that based on a trained model, they get a way of approximating this function. And now they can calculate it. And also note, it does not run over all configurations here because that would take, you know, an infinity, right? In the problem you had, we had more than 100 different variables. And that means the number of configurations is 100 factorial. We'll never get through that. But it has a smart way of numerically approximating it. And that's why we like the algorithm.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Torsten, may I have a follow-up question?
Please.
So in this formula we're looking at, you said that we subtract one player. What about if two players are correlated? Shouldn't we then try to subtract two or three and try all combinations of that?
And the reason why we subtract one player here is because we're calculating the Shapley value for that player, right? But the correlation is included here in the sense that, let's say that I only contributes a lot when J is also in, right? Without J, no contribution. Well, then I is evaluated because sometimes J is in this constellation of agents, and sometimes not. And that is why the average is done over all possible constellations.
It makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah, it's implicitly included.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. No other questions? Well, while you think about it, I can then say, I can stop sharing, we can return to shared values if we want. I can say that for between now and 1 o'clock, Carl and I are working on actually trying to give you a report back on your small project, an individual report for each and every one of you who handed in. It turns out that that's not as easy, but nevertheless, I intend at 1:15 to go through, how did you do and what does it look like and so on. So I hope you will join us then, and I hope you will also excuse if Carl and I, meanwhile, are a little busy. Yeah, I see that Julius had a question. Could you then use SHAP to choose which events to include in your model and not only which features? The answer is yes, in principle, but usually you want your model to work on all events. But what is interesting is that you can, for example, say, if I suddenly don't have all the features available, then I can tell from the SHAP values which events are going to be more poorly predicted than others.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
Yeah, okay, cool. Ida, how do we determine which features to use given their SHAP values? Well, that's because you sum them. Haida. So you don't say for which one, you just say, well, I'll make a sum of them. Let's go back to the slides. Say here, or in fact, here. Right? So if you took the sum of SHAP values for the variable PR hat for all events, then it gave this much, which means that this is a good variable, and I can tell you many of you also found that, so that's good.
Okay, yes, but so what I mean is, how do I determine how many variables I need to get in? Like, for example, when you do PCA, you can be like, oh, I want 96% of the explained variance. That should be good enough for my data, to be explanatory of my data. But, like, but here I just get some values and some lines, and I don't really know where to work.
Excellent question, Haida. Thanks for asking that, because no algorithm can tell you that. This is where the human and the scientist and the education and the experience steps in. I'm showing this slide because here the question is really, how much do we want to include? And the list is endless down, and you get less and less in. And the question is, how complicated a model do you want to build? Is speed a problem? Is memory a problem? Is training time a problem? And I can tell you in the case at hand here, if you have to evaluate how efficient your algorithm is, then sometimes you can't do it from the data. What do you do then? Well, then you do it in simulation, but it turns out that some variables may not be well simulated. So while they would contribute to the overall power of whatever algorithm you're doing, they might give you a wrong prediction for how efficient is it in the end.
Okay, but so I get that you can't really, like, there's no hard set method for determining that. But what I mean is, what is, like, some intuitive explanation for what it means to have that one variable has a SHAP value that is twice the size of another value of another variable's SHAP value?
Okay. It means that it contributes twice as much to the loss function, meaning that if you remove the variable with twice as high a sum of SHAP values, then the loss function will go up twice as much as if you remove one with half. Does that make sense? You're pondering the answer. That's fair. It's not exactly this linearity, because this refers to two games described by this. So, but that is what the sums represent. And while I'm in share, I can't see the chat, so... All right, did the answer make sense, Haider?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Other questions or comments? All right, and then one last thing, and this is regarding the exam. I hope that by the end of the day, hopefully before 5, but otherwise, to actually come with a proposal for the time plan regarding next Wednesday with presenting the projects. And the way this works is that people have had the chance to write me if they have constraints, and I've had one person, one group write me, and that's perfectly fine. But otherwise, I expect everyone to be there and everyone to be grading the other group's work. And the reason for that is that part of this course is also the capability of understanding other people's work on machine learning. So while we want you to grade the others, it's not going to have an influence on their grade, because we will do that part exclusively. But to some extent, that allows us to see if you have, well, at least hopefully a positive correlation with the scores we give. So, and don't worry, that doesn't count much in your overall score. But we wanted to include that dimension of in the course. Yeah. Any other questions? No. Well, then I think I will stop sharing. And how about we take a break now? And then we just keep Zoom open, but I'll stop recording. And we'll be available, but actually right now it will be mostly Zoe available if you have any questions. However, I will also be available with short interruptions here and there. All right? And if nothing else, I'll see you 1:15 for what is hopefully the almost Kegel-like revealing of the scores and the rankings and everything. Meanwhile, enjoy and work happily on project whatever you wish.